You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks. I've been a small business owner for years, and I've come to realize that there's a certain paradox to working for yourself. The more money you make, the more of a hassle it can be. Having to hound clients to get what you're owed, then making payments to employees and vendors, and finally having to account for every dollar that goes in and out so you don't get audited. It's exhausting, and worse, it eats into your quality of life. If you're tired of chasing down payments for your small business, let me tell you about Wave. With Wave's easy-to-use invoicing software, you can customize your invoices, look professional, and get paid faster for your work. Use Wave's recurring invoicing feature so you can sit back, relax, and get back to doing what you love. Create your account at waveapps.com/kick and get started with 100% free and unlimited invoicing. That's waveapps.com/kick.
I made a horrible business decision. I got married and had two children. My daughters make me take them out for ice cream 3 times a week, and I do it like an idiot. Oh, they're so entitled. They walk into that shop and just... No. We have a mean girl. Yeah, I didn't know they were real. I feel guilty. I made it. I feed it. I'm keeping it alive. Now, the responsibility when you have these people, sometimes late at night, my wife is asleep without a care in the world. And I'm standing naked alone in the hallway, wrapped with fear, because I know their lives depend on me. And I can't tell anyone about it. I can't wake my daughter up at 2 o'clock in the morning to sit on the end of her bed. Hey, honey, are you awake? Hey. You ever feel like you're not gonna make it?
That was a clip from comedian Tom Papa's new Netflix special, Tom Papa, You're Doing Great. In this age of insurmountable consumption of media, and where bad news travels fast from all directions, Tom Papa wants to remind us to take care of ourselves, embrace who you've become, and absorb the beauty of life. There are a lot of challenges and responsibilities we take on in life, like family, work, climate change, and social media. But if we find someone who loves us for who we are, whether it's a human or a goldfish, Tom believes we'll be just fine. And today, Tom joins me on the podcast to reveal where his trademark optimism comes from, why he rejects the cynicism often associated with stand-up comedy, and what he learned about being true to your comedic voice while touring with Jerry Seinfeld. He opens up about his anxiety over sending his daughter off to college and warning her that most men's nice guy act is a total fraud. Plus, Tom talks about his own real-life ghost story, the lie of social media, the myth of the good old days, and the symbiotic relationship between baking and writing comedy. Coming up with Tom Papa in just a moment. With more than 20 years as a stand-up comedian, Tom Papa is one of the top comedic voices in the country, finding success in film, TV, radio, and podcasts, as well as on the live stage. Papa is a frequent panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a writer and performer on the public radio variety show Live From Here, and host of a daily SiriusXM show, What a Joke, with Papa and Fortune, and the podcast Come to Papa. He's also the star of 4 streaming stand-up specials, including his latest, titled You're Doing Great, available on Netflix beginning February 4th. Tom Papa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I love to say your name, by the way. Tom Papa just rolls off the tongue so beautifully.
It's funny. I noticed that with children.
Oh, yeah.
The children love saying it all. They like putting it all together. They don't just say Tom or it's Tom Papa.
Tom Papa.
It's one thing to them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah, that shows where my IQ level is, I guess. Is that Italian or
now
what?
No, you just like rhythm. Yeah, that's it's a Sicilian name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, came from Palermo.
Do you ever like lead with your Sicilian heritage? You need to intimidate anyone or something?
No. And now that I'm watching Sebastian Maniscalco's career, I'm thinking I should have. I should have gone in all in on it. And then other people, the Greek community thinks that I'm Greek.
Oh, really?
They assume that Papa, which is spelled P-A-P-A.
A shortened version of Papadopoulos or something?
Exactly. And I had an old Greek driver pick me up in Florida once, and he's holding up my name, you know, at the airport. And he says, "You're Greek." I said, "No, I'm Italian." He goes, "No, Papa, it's shortened." I'm like, "No, it's from Palermo." He said, Palermo, Sicily. Well, we had it first. You're Greek.
That's great.
I was like, well, how far back are we taking this? And then I was talking to a friend of mine, a Greek comedian, and I said, you know, if things don't work out and I need to give my career a boost, I'm thinking of making up a story that it did 23andMe and it turns out I'm all Greek. And he said, you don't want to do that. There's only like 200,000 of us in the whole country. He goes, it's not a big audience.
Yeah, and then you lose the Turkish audience.
So, right, yeah, exactly.
There's not much upside there.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, I'm sticking with the Italian.
Well, I got to tell you, I absolutely loved your special. I felt good.
Yeah,
I felt good after it. You know, it was like comedic chicken soup for the soul. And I think we need that right now because there's so much negativity in the world and, you know, we always think that we're falling behind or we're not keeping up with the guy next door or some stranger on Instagram.
Yeah.
How do you manage to keep life in perspective?
Yeah, that's I'm glad that's the way you came away from it feeling, because that was my intent. And it's kind of, you know, you go out and you shoot a special and you go out and you work on your next endeavor and what you're creating new material. And the audience was dictating that I head more in that direction.
Huh.
You know, I didn't start out with the title, You're Doing Great. I just was doing my act. And I'm optimistic by nature. And I just got this feeling like, well, this is an illusion. This is really an illusion that we're not that, we shouldn't feel as frantic and anxiety filled as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And watching the news isn't helping us. It's actually,
sure,
and looking at it on our phones isn't helping us. It's making us more anxious, and we're being manipulated into this feeling that we're not doing enough and that we're failing. And then you're looking at people on social media who are posting fake lives, and you think, well, why does my life pale in comparison to that? And that's an illusion.
Yeah.
So we've kind of dipped into this whole thing, and I was like, wait a minute. You're doing all right. Like I would say to my audience, like, you're doing great that you were able to come here. Let's put this in perspective. Your life is better than you think. And people were coming up after the show and saying, thank you for telling me that I'm doing great. Like, sincerely, like, really, grabbing my arm. Thank you for saying that. You never hear that. And I was like, well, I'm going to keep going down this path. And why not be less cynical about comedy? Why not be positive and see if I can still be as funny and insightful?
Yeah.
And that was my mission statement.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that really stands out about your comedy is just this general sense of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of unusual in an art form that tends towards cynicism.
Yeah.
Have you always been a pretty positive guy?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
And I think it, I have been. And I in a community of comedians, which there's a good amount of, if not outright mental illness, a lot of
right.
people battling sure. depression and trying to figure out where they're headed. And there's like a lot of complicated heads in comedy.
Yeah.
And I know, and I was aware of this as a kid before all that we were able to articulate this. I know that my chemical makeup allows me to be optimistic. You know what I mean? Like,
okay,
I could wake up in high school and open my eyes and feel crummy and tell myself, "Let's go. Let's make this let's make this a good day. Come on, let's go." And by the time I came down and was eating my cereal, I would be like, not elated, but
that's a real talent, though.
In a more positive frame of mind, right?
Yeah.
But I know that's not, you can't just tell people that are battling depression that they can do that.
Sure.
But I am totally aware, or I believe it is totally possible, that while you may need therapy and you may need other things, you can do things to at least create a story for yourself in your life that is more positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it came from my grandparents. And these were people who, especially my grandmothers. These were people that went through the World Wars, went through depression, the Great Depression, had no money, had real struggles living on the East Coast in New Jersey. And they had every reason. They had people, sick children. They had every reason to, illnesses to themselves, every reason to stop and quit and mope and quit and just feel bad about themselves and their lives. And they did not. And they admonished us if we ever complained. And they were just in our face and telling you, be grateful, and this is a wonderful life, and you are blessed, and let's go. Let's go. And let's have fun, and let's come on. Stop your complaining. And that, I'm telling you, from hearing that as a young child repeatedly, it left its mark on, on the one side, I'm one of 23 grandchildren. They all carry that with them to different degrees, but they all literally carry that little grandma handbook in their head, and it worked. So I really believe that you have to work at this attempt at living, you know, in a better space.
Yeah. I rarely have met a person from the Greatest Generation who wasn't a generally pretty happy person.
Isn't it crazy?
Appreciate the good times, I guess, when you go through all that.
I know. And I, you know, I look at my children who are wonderful people. You'd like them. but they're, the metric for suffering for them is...
Right. I know.
Is really skewed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if...
I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I always wonder what the Greatest Generation would think, you know, after having gone through the Great Depression and a World War, Cold War, polio, Jim Crow, and all this stuff, you know, and here our biggest problem these days, even though it is a legitimate issue, is social media.
Yes.
It's like, Facebook has made our lives so hard.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't live up to Instagram standards.
Yeah. You know? Now, to be fair to my kids and to us, anyone living right now, we are the first human beings that are being inundated with this bad news 24 hours a day.
Right.
Even when Hitler was raging across Europe, you weren't being told about it in your pocket night and day. So, I mean, we are caught up in a very unique, which we're still muddling through and trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
How do you control all of this? Because no other, we're the first generation on the planet that's had to, and the kids.
Yeah.
It's a weird world. I was walking out of the house with my wife the other night. We were going to walk the dog, and my teenage daughters are inside. And this was the day that Kobe had passed.
Right.
And so they'd been talking about that. And, you know, there's no telling your kids news stories. By the time you see them in the morning, they've got it all.
Yeah.
So they were already mourning that. And then on our way out that night to walk the dog, my daughter goes, "Oh, did you hear the virus is in the coronavirus is in Orange County?"
Yeah.
And they both started doing the hands up thing, like put your hands in the air, and they're like, "Plague, here comes the plague, here comes the plague." And we're like, this is a weird world for these kids. You know what I mean? Like, there could have been a plague coming when we were kids, and you really didn't know about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure that, like, the Greatest Generation or anyone around there who, you know, was around for the Spanish flu epidemic or, like, polio didn't do that.
No. So, we have struggles, but I think that they definitely, my grandparents led me into a way of thinking that was, that
you have a lot under your control. Mm-hmm. You can control how to live your life, and you can put that phone down and decide, I'm going to have meals with my family, and mm-hmm. that's going to be a priority, not hearing Wolf Blitzer scare the crap out of me at the airport.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I sound like such a crotchety old man now because I'm like, oh, everything was better in the 80s. But, you know, my logical brain tells me that's not really the case. I think they even have a clinical term for it. It's like golden age syndrome or something.
Yeah. Oh,
the grass is always greener.
I know.
Or was greener.
I talked about that in my act. That's like a last minute. It's funny when you do these specials, you have this act that you've been working on for a long time, and then when you get close to filming it, it's like painting. Eventually, someone's got to take it away from you because you can continue working on it to the end of time.
Right. Enemy is the perfect of the good.
Yeah.
well, I don't know. If okay.
Yeah.
Perfect is the enemy of the good.
Of the good, right. Yeah. Exactly. But you have to like let it go at a certain point. But so as I'm filming the thing, like this in this last month, this whole thing of going back to the good old days crept into my act. And I was like, the good old, they didn't know how to do anything back there. I mean, we're just figuring it out now, and we think it's a mess. But you do not want to live. Be careful what you're asking for. That was hospitals, no Advil. Just no living a life without Advil. You ever go to the cabinet? I say, you ever go to the cabinet and you realize you're out of Advil? I just lay on the ground and hope to die. Imagine a whole life without that in hospitals. Please, no, it's much better now.
Even going back to the 50s, I don't think that there was good deodorant in the 50s. Smelling good is a relatively recent phenomenon in our history.
I know. I was thinking about our skateboards when we were kids.
Oh, yeah?
Like when
were you a skater?
No, I couldn't. There were no skateboards.
Oh, okay.
It was like a piece of wood with stool wheels on it, like that you would put in the bottom of a stool. Someone was trying to make skateboards, but they were death traps, and we made jumps, and kids were like scraping their faces off. But you know, look, there's a lot of tragedy and there's a lot of hardship, but don't wish to go backwards by any means.
Oh yeah,
there were no peaceful pastures back then, and it's kind of an interesting thing because my older daughter is a senior and she's going away to school next year.
Oh, cool! And where? What school does she know yet?
She's going to Vassar.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
good for her.
Yeah, she's very excited, but she's just now learning the reality of what's gone on in the world. Like she's learning, you know, that America doesn't have a clean record, you know, that nobody has a clean record, that there's just been takeover and abuse of other, you know, we come in and deal with the Indians and then, you know, then we go and spread our influence around the Middle East. And you could just see it cascading onto her. Like, wait a minute. I thought everything was, wait, aren't we the good guy? Like, wait, what happened? And it was an interesting thing. This was just happening last night when we were talking. I said, you're going to learn a lot and you're going to, and a lot of it is true, but it's not just us. It's the whole world is, this is about humanity and humanity has an ugly story and you're going to have to, if I can give you any advice, as you go out and she loves school and she's going to digest all of this stuff. I said, you just have to keep remembering that you have to balance hope with that because it's easy to hear these stories and feel hopeless. It's easy to think we've lost.
Yeah.
But you're going to be your biggest goal or your biggest obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
Balancing some kind of hope in the face of all the stuff you're going to learn. We've done it. Your mother and I are totally aware of how hellish things can be. But, you know, we're also having a good time with you at the beach.
Yeah, what was it that Winston Churchill said? Democracy is the worst form of government in the world, except for every other form of government.
So. Right, yeah. Yeah. It's
everything's relative.
No, I know. So hopefully, I know the first Thanksgiving that she comes home is going to
be some arguments.
Oh, my God. And I know we're going to be to blame for some of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You told us we couldn't recycle styrofoam.
Now, is this the daughter that you refer to in the special as a mean girl? You say you raised a mean girl.
I won't I won't cop to that. I think I like you a lot already, but I'm not going to admit okay. which one is the mean girl.
Okay, well, one is a mean girl. See, now I'm about to have my first daughter, my first child, about 2 weeks, you know, and it's a girl.
Oh, okay.
So now I'm worried. How do I avoid raising a mean girl?
You don't.
You don't?
No.
Beyond my control?
Beyond your control.
Okay. Well, then I have no culpability, so that's good,
None.
Too.
No, you really don't. Okay. You really don't. I mean, you can give them advice, but it is remarkable how they were who they were before we left the hospital.
Yeah.
Before we took them home. They are the same people that they were when they... That's going to be a funny... I wish I could be there. That is the funniest moment of your first child is when they say, okay... You can leave, and you and your wife walk out the front door with this human being. It's like they're letting us.
I know. I'd be like, I don't want to leave.
No, it's
don't
like
put
if
this
you buy
on me.
If you buy a video game at Best Buy, they're double checking stuff before you go to the parking lot. This they're just like, have a good luck with your life. But no, I'm telling you, they are exactly the same. My daughters in the maternity ward, they were they come. They're really pretty baked. By the time they show up. So anyway, the mean girl thing.
Yeah.
One of them was going to be mean and one of them was going to be a diva. And that's kind of the way it shook itself out.
But you kind of have to be a mean girl. I mean, women have to deal with men.
She's
going off to college. Is she prepared for that? 100%.
That's been my thing. Like I had that joke in my act for a long time about her being mean. And then it just occurred to me, like, why are you saying it like a bad thing? Like, you girls should be mean. Like, you've got to deal with life and you got to deal with all these hairy ass men. You've got to go deal with all this stuff. I mean, you know, I was saying to my wife that, you know, they don't know how bad men can. I'm the only guy in their life and I'm pretty great. You know what I mean? Like, most guys are, and they're going to go out and meet all these, like, horrible people.
Mm-hmm.
My friend wrote a manifesto for his daughter when she went away to college, and it was all the truth-telling about men.
Oh, that's great.
For her to have when she goes out into the world, and I kind of feel like writing that.
Yeah. I mean, thank God Me Too came just in the nick of time, I think.
100%. I mean, there is a real, I believe, a real lasting impact of that where there's no more... When my mother went to work, excuse me, in the 80s, early 80s, I guess, you know, this was advertising. This was not a real misogynist environment. And
no, not if you watch Mad Men, though.
Well yeah, good point. And but I mean, she was with creatives.
Uh-huh.
And still, like, she just laughed off all the inappropriate stuff they said and grabbing. And, you know, it's just the way. I mean, our daughters will not have to deal with that.
Yeah.
Which is pretty great.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
It's going to be strange when I have conversations with them and they don't realize that women have been treated as prey throughout basically all of human history.
Well, that is.
Until they were born.
You're not wrong.
Yeah.
That as a father, that is a concern of mine.
Mm-hmm.
That they. Especially with their dress, that was the first time that it really dawned on me.
Oh, yeah.
When they want to wear like a half top and, you know, their belly's out. And I always remember my father yelling at the kids, at my sisters.
Telling you not to wear a half top?
Yeah, I know. I was like, Dad, I just want to wear it. No, but my sisters, like, it was a big thing. And, you know, my grandfather to my mother was like, you do not go out of the house dressed like that. You are, what are you, you know? And... My kids are, I never say that to my daughters. I never say. But, you know, they're starting to go out at night and stuff. And they're dressed, you know, what they think is great. And they feel powerful in it. But there's a lot for a creepy dude to look at. And that was one of the first, like, uncomfortable arguments we had about this stuff. And I said, you got to be careful. And she said, this isn't about me. This is about them.
Mm-hmm.
This is about these men. They've got to change their behavior. And I was like, well, you're 100% right.
It's a fair point.
You're totally right. And in your school where they were working on that actively, I think that's great. But I can also know that if you go into a bar, there are going to be men that haven't read that pamphlet.
Right.
They're not on board with that yet. So you need to be aware of it at the very least and know what you're dealing with. There are... It's not always so great out there. And so there's that, you know, we're in this transformative moment where, yes, they should be empowered. Yes, it is. We have to correct the behavior of men.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got a long way to go, so you don't want to get caught up in that transition.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. There's another thing that you said in your book, and it also creeps into your act several times, is that all men are basically programmed by evolution to be ruthless, aggressive monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole nice guy act is just complete fraud.
Yeah, you got to be careful because there's, there's right now, you know, there's a lot of guys pretending to be woke,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right,
right. Oh, and then, you know, then you're alone with them and who knows who pops out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is a tough spot for men for sure. You know, you do have this thing inside you that's aggressive. You have an aggressive, mm-hmm. that's why men are good at football and building, you know, steel bridges, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's a thing in us that is a very powerful thing.
Right. Protecting. Yeah.
Yeah. And all those instincts. It just popped into my head. I'm just so excited for you that you're going to be having this baby. There's all these things. There's all these things that are going to happen to you. But when you say protective, we were living in New York when my first was born.
Oh yeah.
And we were walking down the street with her in the stroller for the first time. Or near the first, like for the first year. And I was like a crazy person. I was walking. I was like a guard dog in front of my wife in the stroller. Just like ready. Total instinct. Nothing planned. No, like I didn't see bad guys. I was just up there as the male, like, back off. Pushing people, pushing old ladies out of the way. My daughter's coming through. It was pure protective instinct. So there is these strong instincts that human beings have, mm-hmm. and it's, can you educate it and use it for good rather than evil is, I think that's our struggle, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, do you think that men are better off ignoring that part of our brain or I don't know, or is that why we die of heart attacks before women do?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think you should be, you can't fight, you can't fight nature, but you can corral it and, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. To act like all these, like we could just be all peaceful and nice is kind of, you know, we have, I'm sure you have friends like I do that don't stand a chance of being woke.
Yeah. And I'm sure that I have moments in my life where I was not woke at all.
Right.
And I probably would not like to look back at that moment in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, I plan on telling my daughter that the nicest person she ever met, myself included, has probably been a complete douchebag multiple times in their life at some point or another.
Yes. I'm talking about it now in my new act where I say, look, I want to be better. And I do feel like I'm optimistic about where we're headed mm-hmm. in this new year. And I feel like obnoxious people have had a real moment. Like mm-hmm. over the last 2 years, you've seen a lot of testicles hanging off of pickup trucks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's been really in our face.
God.
And I do feel like it's going the other way. But that doesn't mean that I'm perfect. Like I go through all these examples. And when I say I want people to be better, I also want myself. I want to be better. And I'm not. And I know none of us are. Like we drive here in Los Angeles. For some reason, there's something in everyone that when you're merging, even though it's that guy's turn, you're not letting him in.
Yeah.
Why? Why are you all of a sudden on the bumper and like, no, not today, pal. I'm just giving it to you. Why? Why? We all have that thing in us. So, you know, we fail all the time. But if you're conscious of trying not to fail, I think that's all you can ask for.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. See, I gave up driving probably about 4 years ago.
No way.
And to just because it's not a productive use of my time. And it's, you know, I can take a nap. I can be reading a book. I can do other things. And
around.
I don't need all that stress. But now I just get mad at the Uber driver.
Why
are you getting off the freeway?
Yeah. I had this radio show that I do early in the morning on Sirius. And they offered, you can Uber. We'll pay for your Uber. I took it twice. I was like, I can't. This guy swerving. The other guy was getting off the wrong exit. I can't do it. I'm getting nauseous in the back. I'm like, I got to get behind the wheel.
Yeah, you're like my wife. She gets nauseous in Ubers. If she's not behind the wheel, she gets nauseous. Yeah.
If it was like a like a big Rolls Royce where the butler comes out and opens the door, puts you in.
Grey Poupon.
Maybe I could do that. I can't do these Ubers.
Yeah. See, I'm going to say that and no one will know what I'm talking about when I reference Rolls Royce and Grey Poupon.
That's so funny because I almost made an Arthur. The movie Arthur, and I thought, no one's going to remember that.
God, he was so funny.
Man, it was so
good. Dudley Moore.
I just saw it the other night. It was on Turner Classic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and Dudley Moore and Liza Minnelli. He was
John
so
good.
Oh, so good in that. Yeah. And it was a Bud Yorkin film, which I saw.
Oh, yeah.
And I was lucky enough to meet Bud Yorkin before he passed.
Really?
And he took a real liking to me. He saw me doing stand-up at this event, and he had lunch with me in L.A., and then I did his birthday party, and it was like, and he didn't realize that he was part of All in the Family. He was with Norman Lear. He created all of these great comedies, and he was like,
what a legend.
Yeah, and just to be around him, and
God.
That he thought that I had something, was just like, oh, well, thank you. Now, what are we going to do? But I think I met him like 20 years too late.
Yeah, no, I always hate to ask this question because I know that you probably get it every time you talk to someone, but who were the people who influenced you? Who were the comedians you looked up to?
When I was young, it was Steve Martin, you know, because he was so silly, and I didn't know the irony behind it. I just saw him just being
so this
totally
was early
free.
Steve Martin.
This was early
when he was still doing stand up.
Yeah. In one summer, I went to my friend had older brothers, and we sat in his older brother's room with a bunch of other guys, and I heard Steve Martin's Let's Get Small, and I didn't even understand most of the jokes, but they were all laughing. And then I went to my other friend's house, and in his basement, we listened to George Carlin's Class Clown.
Oh, yeah.
In that one summer, these two comedy albums, and that was the first time I learned that grown-ups could make a career out of being funny people. Like, I had no idea. That was like seventh grade summer, and I was funny, but I didn't know that could be a career. Wow. And that was it. That's when I said, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And then I saw Bill Cosby's Himself, that special. That had a big influence. And then I just started digesting, I was always anything funny. When you're funny, you like Wacky Packs. Do you remember what those were?
No,
they were
what's
like
a Wacky Pack?
They were like baseball cards, but for funny people. Like they were
really?
They
for
were
comedians.
No, or they were just they were cards, trading cards that would make fun of brands. Like
It was kind of like
Mad
almost
Magazine.
Like I was just about to say, Mad Magazine-y.
Yeah, they would take smart water and make it dumb water.
Yeah,
and they would make it silly.
I think I do remember
any,
that.
But you know what I mean? Like anything that was taking the regular world and making it funny and being a little, I just was absorbing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, why is a Gumby walking around? What is Fred Flintstone doing? What are these Wacky Packs? What's this Mad Magazine with all these other National Geographics and Time? What's this one? You know what I mean? Like, that was the only thing I was interested in, was digesting that stuff.
Yeah. Is Mad still around? Did that
it
go
is.
Under?
No.
Or it didn't go under?
No.
Or National Lampoon went under?
National Lampoon went under. Yeah. I think Cracked went under.
Okay. Yeah, I remember Cracked.
Cracked was like the lesser Mad.
Yeah.
Those are gone. But Mad is still there. And treat yourself once in a while as a grown-up. Go to, you're in the Hudson News or the 7-Eleven. Get yourself a Mad Magazine.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah, I didn't even know that there was still an option.
You can do it.
I still think that The Jerk is hands down the funniest movie ever made.
Yeah, one of them.
I say
for
it
sure.
all the time.
Yeah.
I've seen it. God, 2 dozen times at least. And I still laugh. And I think it's funny because whether you're a 70-year-old man or a 14-year-old boy,
it
still plays.
Well, think about the creative lineup of that. It was Steve Martin and Carl Reiner, right? Putting those two together and making this thing. That's okay. You're in a good, weird, comedic proven space.
Yeah,
that should be funny.
Yeah. Now, I read that I guess your first big break came from Jerry Seinfeld. You were friends and you toured with him, is that right?
Yeah. I always say that was my big break. Like, it wasn't like walking out on a show and that was the night that I it was meeting him and him telling me that I was funny. And then I just grabbed onto his coattails for the next 10 years, really. And I learned so much about being a comedian, he confirmed the way I like to write and perform. It mm-hmm. was I wasn't a guy that was at the time in New York. There was a lot of guys that all the guys that were ahead of me were seemed to be partying and drinking and living a decadent life, and that wasn't me. And then Jerry came in, who at the time he was done with his TV show and was getting back to stand up, and mm-hmm. he just confirmed that I could be that kind of a comedian. Huh. You know what I mean? And then also the confirmation that this guy was telling people I was good, that was that opened doors for me too. So yeah, that was my big break for sure. Yeah, it's like, you know, if you were an athlete and you were to meet, you know, Michael Jordan, and he was like, that's a good one.
Did you learn anything about comedy from him?
Oh my God. Yeah. I learned a lot. The biggest thing I learned, I mean, there's so many little minutiae things about writing, and there's so many small things about performing and how you prepare and all that. But the biggest thing really was that this is a real craft. This is something that you can work at and get better at, and you should, because how lucky are you that you can participate in this craft?
Yeah.
That was the biggest thing that I got from him.
Yeah. Your act, as we said, it tends to be pretty positive. Was that a tough sell back then? I mean, you know, did you ever think, oh, I'm not snarky enough, I'm not cynical enough, I'm not cool enough?
Yeah. I wanted to be cooler, not even for the audiences as much for the other comedians in New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were, you know, before you're proving yourself, there's a lot of comedians, you know, smoking cigarettes and leaning against the back wall. And, and then I would come up and be like loud and funny and, you know, just filled with energy and just out of fear, you know, and kind of smiley.
Yeah.
And the comedians like to know that there's something wrong with you. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't giving off that vibe. Yeah. And I remember like trying to be dirty or trying to be cooler a couple times, and the audience wouldn't let me do it. These people who just met me a second ago, you could tell your vibe. Like I could tell with you, like, if all of a sudden you were like, you know what, I'm really into drinking Jack Daniels in the middle of the day in a bar, I'm like, no, you're not. You know what I mean? The audience was like, no, just be yourself. So, it, you know, when you're finding yourself and you have all these influences around you, it's like trying to go to a new school. It's like, I want to fit in, but then you realize later on that those aren't the kids I want to fit in with. I want to fit in with these kids.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to be yourself, that's when it kind of happens.
Yeah, I'm pretty amazed nowadays at just how much you're able to juggle with your career, because you've got TV shows and a lot of movies, you got stand-up, you have a book coming out next.
Yeah,
I mean,
another book coming out, right?
How do you manage that and two kids?
It's, two kids, yeah.
And keep a happy wife.
It's a lot. But over the last 5 years, I just realize that if I want to do all the things that I want to do, if I want to write these books, anything that doesn't entail writing, I feel isn't that hard. Like, I feel like...
So acting roles and that kind of thing.
Yeah, like it's time consuming in its own way, but you can kind of, you know, it's the writing that is the thing. It's like, I haven't seen a movie on a plane in 4 years because I did two books back to back. And then I also write these monologues for Live From Here, Out in America.
Yeah.
I have to write 7 minutes of stand-up each week that I'm doing that.
Wow.
And that's, you know, which
that's not
and
easy.
I'm not testing it. The only time anyone hears it is when it's on the air. So that has to be rewritten as much as I can before I show up. So I'm just writing all the time. And I feel like... that's it. I just don't. My time is my family, and my time is the work, and that's all I'm doing.
Yeah.
I don't. You know, I'm not going to bars. I'm not
don't have
going
a lot
to
of
golf
hobbies.
Weekends. Yeah. My hobby is baking bread in my house.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which really, I think I discovered that while I was starting to get serious about writing, and I think that that
bacon?
Fed each other. Yeah.
Interesting.
That they fed each other. Like, I'm able to write, and about the time that I have to go turn the dough over is about the time that I should get up from the desk and do
it.
It
all works out. Huh?
Do it for 10 minutes and then come back. That routine had a weird way of working itself out. But
that's amazing.
It's all work. It's all work, all work, all the time. And I love it. It's not that I'm like, oh, I got to get in there. And I truly, truly enjoy doing it and realize, hey, that, you know, I have an opportunity here to create this stuff and people want it. So I'm not going to start a video game habit. at this point.
And being able to combine your love of baking with some kind of an actual project that pays, what a blessing that's been. I mean, your Food Network show Baked is just terrific.
Oh,
I'm
thanks.
A fan.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I know. I don't think we're going to make another season of it, which is kind of upsetting because
is it going to be weird baking without someone watching you now?
Yeah. I just, you know what? It's weird. I didn't. Yeah, exactly. I am actually going to post some YouTube videos about it because people keep asking, like, how do you do it? So I
your sourdough recipe is a big deal, apparently.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I think that I am going to put it out there. But it's weird. Like, I feel like you don't want to spend your show business money, currency on everything.
Uh-huh.
I was baking bread because I loved it. And I talked about it on some podcasts and it became a bigger thing. And when the Food Network asked if I would do this show, it was like, yeah, that's fun. But I wasn't going to want it like I want to be in a movie or that I want to get my next special made. Or I wasn't going to burn any anxiety on the show.
Yeah.
But after doing a season of it and meeting all of these people who bake for a living, I would go to each different city and I would hang out with these people that bake. They were such great people. Like, very seldom does an obnoxious person decide they're going to open a shop making cupcakes for people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Bakers are pretty
they're
good
a different
people.
Breed. Yeah.
And I missed them. Like, every one of them, when I go back to a city, I'll go and visit them. And I just, it had a heart to it that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
And that made me want to do the show more. So I ended up spending my show business anxiety trying to get my silly baking show back on. But my daughter kind of pointed out when I was like, I don't know if they're going to do it. They just ran more episodes on the Cooking Network, so maybe that's interest. And my daughter said, I feel like you're going to do that show.
Right.
Baking show. It may be 20 years from now.
Nothing dies anymore.
Especially
no TV show dies.
Right. And especially if you're passionate about it. Like, they're not stopping me from visiting bakers when I'm on the road doing stand-up and going home and making it my – like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't need a TV show to get into this in the first place. I just want sticky buns. And I met an Amish guy that told me how to make them.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, you say in the special that your ultimate dream once, you know, the kids get through college and everything's paid off is to open a bagel shop by the beach.
Yeah. Not own one. Work in one.
Yeah.
I'm not doing paperwork.
Yeah.
I want to, when I leave at 3 p.m, I'm done. But I do believe that would be a pretty great life.
Yeah.
Sit there in a bagel shop in the Jersey Shore.
Oh, wait, you're from New Jersey.
I'm from New Jersey. Yeah. The beaches there are like a hidden secret. It's not the Jersey Shore that MTV created.
Yeah.
You go a little further south. I still haven't found beaches that are as nice. I mean,
really?
Hawaii,
no kidding.
All these places, I'm telling you.
Huh.
You know, every once in a while a toilet gets washed up on shore, but you put that aside.
Yeah.
The beaches are amazing.
Huh. I didn't know.
Have
that.
A little life. My kids will be gone. My wife and I'll downsize, live in this tiny little bungalow. I'll make bagels during the morning, give her some sesame when I come home, watch the sunset. That sounds like that's a good goal.
Sounds good,
yeah.
I don't know about that business model, though. I mean, the bread industry has really taken a hit lately with Atkins and no carbs. And
I know.
Suddenly everyone has a gluten allergy.
Yes, but ask yourself this. Why have people been eating bread for centuries?
Mm-hmm.
Centuries.
Yeah.
And then we show up and we're suddenly not allowed to eat bread.
Yeah.
And people are getting sick from it. It's not the bread. It's we are being poisoned by all of these additives and things that people are putting into bread, into everything.
Yeah.
And that's making us sick. We're eating things that are not food.
Interesting. Okay.
I'm not kidding when I say that.
Okay.
Bread is flour, water, salt, and yeast.
Huh.
And if you make it the right way and you do all the right things and don't add anything into it, no sugar, no nothing, you can eat that as centuries of human beings have. Without a problem, you can do it too. You're not going to get fat from it. You're not going to have gluten issues. look, if you're celiac and you have real issues, fine. But I have a lot of friends that were figuring out, they're just sick. They're not, this isn't like a trendy thing. These are people that have they feel crappy.
Okay.
And they're trying to figure out why.
So it's real. It's not just
in their
imagination.
No, they're trying to figure out why, but they're missing, and I would give them my bread and they could eat it and be fine. So it showed me this isn't purely this gluten rampage that's all of a sudden human beings can't take. It's that they're eating other things that are making them sick. Yeah. And, you know, that's part of the problem of living in America.
Yeah. And I also know that you're kind of part of Steven Soderbergh's repertory players. You were in, The Informant, Behind the Candelabra, and The Nick, which I loved.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it like kind of existing in Gilded Age New York for, I don't know, what was that, a week or two?
It was pretty great. Yeah. It was pretty great. You would love it. It's similar to your building.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Old and creepy.
It was like, you know that hospital that they created that in Queens in this studio? And
really?
Yeah, and you would walk in and everyone's in that dress, that period dress, the early 20th century stuff.
Okay.
And
they really shot in New York. So I assumed it had to be shot in Canada or something like that.
I know.
That.
Isn't that? That's why show
that's
business
cool.
works. Like, I really feel like, well, these shows have to shoot in the... it's such an illusion, but no, that was true. And they would go find these great buildings in like Staten Island and Brooklyn and shoot all the exteriors and stuff. And that was a really neat project. And it's people really miss it. They wanted, I think the idea was that the hospital is the Nick. And that you would, after that season or two, when that was done, you would leap ahead 20 years, same hospital, and deal with what's happening.
Oh, okay. Huh.
And which was sounds pretty great.
Idea.
But they haven't put it together yet. And I don't know if they're working
so
on it or what. But
I mean, it's been a while since the last season.
I know. It has. And I was like, well, my character probably would be pretty, he could make it into the next season. He wouldn't be dead yet.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, that was such a good show. I really miss it. Speaking of creepy old buildings, somewhere along the way, I heard, I don't know if this is true or not, that you live in a haunted house. Is that true?
I do live in a haunted house.
In L.A.?
It does not look like, in L.A.
Okay.
Yeah. And my security camera, you know those little security cameras you can set up and they trigger alerts on your phone if they detect anything? I had set it up and I was on the road and I got my first alert backstage at this comedy club in Denver and it was my dog. I was like, wow, look at this. Like it alerted me and there's my dog in my office. This is so cool. I said, wouldn't this be a great horror movie that you get an alert and there's just a man looking back in the camera?
Oh, yeah.
All right? Now you're off. I don't know where it goes from there.
Yeah, that's like one of those movies, Paranormal Activity or something.
That's the good
footage and all that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any young writer out there wants to take it.
So it's not really haunted. Or it is.
No, wait. As I say that, I pitch that idea to my opening act. I'm like, wouldn't that be a cool movie? And then, bling, I get another alert. And I hit my phone and... there's the alert, and there is the shadowy figure that looks like a ghost. I'm telling you. I'm going to show it to you right now.
Oh, my God.
And you show it to people who, anybody that really doesn't believe in ghosts, they might say it's not. But anybody else who thinks that there's something out there, you see this image. Take a look at that.
Oh, wow. It almost looks like a shadowy figure with a gun.
Yeah. It looks like a guy in a trench coat
terrifying.
With a gun. And this is 10 o'clock at night. No one is in the house but my wife and my daughter.
Oh, my God.
That is not in a room where you would get – we don't live in a city street. Like, that is – you can't explain
that
one away.
I can't think what
that
would be.
I know.
Oh, my God. Now, you don't have any celebrity lineage in your house, do you? It might not be a movie star or something.
Well, that's what I want to look up.
Yeah.
And this is a shout-out to libraries. This is the only people that would know would be the library in town.
There you
because
go.
The house isn't that old.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like Poltergeist.
Yeah.
The land has been there for a long time. Who knows what's buried underneath the house? I know.
Wow.
I know. And then there's weird stuff that happens every once in a while. Like everyone in the house has had a little bit of a saw something.
Oh, that's terrifying.
No, it seems like it doesn't seem mean. It seems
it looks mean. I just looked at it. That did not seem like a friendly ghost.
No, you're right.
Wow.
Yeah, but maybe he's protecting us. I don't know.
Wow. Well, speaking of libraries, you have a new book coming out that's also titled "You're Doing Great." Tell us a little
about
that.
Another reason to stay alive.
What's going to be in there? Yeah.
It's a book of essays. It's kind of similar to the theme we're talking about with the act, but it goes much deeper. It's basically that you. In the introduction, I say, thank you for buying enough of the first book that I can write this one. And I really do enjoy it. And I loved meeting you all on my tour and meeting everyone, but I'm worried about you. And you seem like you're very anxious and you're kind of confused. And I just want to center you and let you know, help you open your eyes to what is good around you. Because as you're fretting and watching the news, it's flying by you and you don't realize the biggest point is you got to take stock now. Like a human being, especially as an adult, you have a short amount of time where it's really great. And you don't want to waste that time worrying about things that are out of your control. So here are some funny essays pointing out the things that I think are pretty positive.
We need to hear these things, man.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Well, again, the book You're Doing Great and Other Reasons to Stay Alive hits shelves in May, and Tom's new special You're Doing Great is available starting February 4th on Netflix. Yeah. Tom Papa, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to be here.
Thanks again to Tom Papa for coming on the show. Once more, be sure to check out Tom's new stand-up special, Tom Papa, You're Doing Great, now streaming on Netflix, and his book of the same name hits stores May 12. For upcoming tour dates, visit TomPapa.com and follow him on Twitter at TomPapa. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.